You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, October 20th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Carl Linskog, assistant professor of history at Raritan Valley Community College, author of Detain and Punish, Haitian Refugees and the World's Largest Immigration Detention System. Also on the program today, Man Cinema continue hacking away at the Build Back Better plan. Meanwhile, Republicans in the Senate will, of course, block the voting rights bill, which can now pass only if the Democrats reform the filibuster. The House Rules Committee is voting at the moment to push Steve Bannon criminal contempt to the full House for a vote. Also, hearing today for Rahm Emanuel's nomination as ambassador to Japan on the seventh anniversary of the killing of Laquan McDonald, a killing Rahm Emanuel attempted at least for several years successfully to cover up. And he was mayor of Chicago. The FDA makes its final proposal for over-the-counter hearing aids, which could dramatically reduce the costs of hearing aids for millions of Americans. New York City mandates vaccine for all city workers, including cops. You don't get a vaccine, you take an unpaid vacation.
Sorry.
Jair Bolsonaro accused of crimes against humanity in his COVID response by a Brazilian congressional panel. And by January, over 70 million Social Security beneficiaries are going to see the largest bump to their benefits in decades. All this and more on today's Majority Report. We should say that bump is going to be a one-time COLA cost of living increase, which, just to remind you as to how far we came, Joe Biden had spearheaded the attempt to cut the cost of living increases for seniors. Obviously, it's seniors are eligible for Social Security. Back during the Obama administration, in fact, did a end run around then majority leader of the Senate, Harry Reid, to try and get that deal done. And talk about what comes around goes around. Right, Emma Vigeland, who's here today?
Right. I am here today. Shocking, I know, but I'm here.
I mean, this may be a little bit of a stretch, but I don't think it's that much of a stretch to say that Joe Biden's pathological desire to believe that the Republican Party was a negotiating partner, I guess maybe 7-8 years ago, perpetuated a lie and a misunderstanding about the Republican Party, and frankly, the so-called moderates, conservative Democrats, that in many respects he fell prey to in the first 10 months of his administration. I think when the history of this Build Back Better bill, which I think by the time we're done with it is going to be, slightly repair some things in a less than fully adequate situation. I don't know if they'll be able to fit that all in the bill.
Build back the bare minimum.
Back the bare minimum. Like, maybe not even, I don't know.
But he really probably build. Not the climate because of a mansion. Mansions are going to get rich.
I believe when the history of this failure to capitalize on the moment comes, because let's be honest, if we're talking about a $1.9 trillion bill over the course of 10 years. I mean, we're talking about something that's not even, what is it, a quarter of our annual commitment to the military? Yep. I mean, there's no, I mean, it's just simply not.
And now they're talking about the child tax credit only being extended for a year or 2 years, which means, say, the Democrats lose the Senate or the House, which is very likely, that's gone, and then they get to own that in an election year. Great move.
This ends
amazing
up being
a
political liability.
Right.
But I think when the history of this bill is written, if it's even large enough to be worth anybody's time, frankly, to write about it, the failure to capitalize on the momentum following the COVID relief bill and Biden's, again, pathological desire to appear bipartisan when he first invited the Republicans in to negotiate with him and then allowed for space for Kyrsten Sinema and Rob Portman to do their bipartisan bill. I mean, we have seen how much those Republicans and conservative Democrats want that infrastructure bill, the so-called bipartisan one, because it has a lot of stuff that basically are just sort of build back, fill up the potholes, that type of stuff. And
they kept progressives out of that entire negotiation process on purpose. And now they're like, yeah, but we get to have a say, and not just a say, we get to dominate the bill that we were going to.
The point is, if you do not allow that to happen, if you do not allow for the space for the Republicans to come in and try and negotiate it and for this bipartisan group to negotiate it, you then roll that into this bill, mm-hmm. and it becomes one bill, and you push it through right after the COVID relief. There's not as much time for forces to amass to fight against it, all the moneyed forces. There is more interest by more members of the Senate to pass this bill because it has the goodies they can't do without. I think that, it's very hard to prove a counterfactual, but I really do think that we're going to be looking back on that moment as the time that the Build Back Better bill was basically DOA, not to get all BBB, DOA.
Right. Thank you, C-3PO.
I was going to say WYD.
Right.
What are you going to do?
SMD.
Shake my damn. What?
Yep.
Yeah, sure.
Sure.
Okay. Well, just whatever on that one. All right. Well, that's the show for today.
Hello.
Here is Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman sitting down with John Berman. There's only so much any members of the House can do at this point, right? I mean, they passed this bill, or I should say, prepared to pass the entire $3.5 trillion bill. And they don't have any leverage. Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman have no leverage with Sinema or Manchin, I guess, to some extent. One could argue that they have some leverage with Chuck Schumer, who has failed to do anything other than act as a concierge for the members of the Senate, failed insofar as seemed to be the only person he trusted in the entire Democratic Party. With the knowledge that Joe Manchin was saying $1.5 trillion. I mean, what if the forces that were in favor of a larger bill were aware 4 months ago that Joe Manchin had said $1.5 trillion?
Yeah, why not just sit on it, though, and not tell anybody about it, Chuck Schumer?
Maybe Bernie Sanders could have been working on that 4 months ago?
Yeah, maybe he didn't have to take out an op-ed in the West Virginia paper to shame Manchin at the 11th hour as these cuts have already happened.
Exactly.
Schumer has let these two members of his caucus dominate, and he's just like let the inmates run the asylum
And to be clear, the opponents of this bill knew what they were attacking 4 or 5 months ago, but the proponents of this bill did not know what they were fighting against.
Yes.
And that is because Chuck Schumer decided, for whatever reason, to sit on that information. I don't even know if Nancy Pelosi knew
she
it.
Didn't. And I mean, there was some reporting that she was pissed about it.
I don't blame her. I would be.
She does a better job than he does in this
because
respect.
Even if you know in July that this isn't going anywhere, why do you let the Democrats go out and embarrass themselves? Because regardless of what you get now, it's going to look like failure. On some level, it is going to failure from a policy standpoint. I'm just talking from a political standpoint. Chuck Schumer is now responsible for the magnification of the failure of the Democrats. I'm not sure that, frankly, they could have passed the entire bill or none of the bill, and it would have made an electoral difference in and of itself in terms of the benefits. But certainly, certainly, going into 2022, this is going to look like a failure for the Democrats. And Chuck Schumer owns at least that part of it by denying full information
to all the stakeholders. Because he thought that he could get him out of that position and didn't want to publicize it. I don't even know what the play was.
I think that Schumer perceives himself as a concierge for the Senate. And so what he was doing was sort of like a bag check. He took it and put it into the cloakroom and hung it on the thing and just said to Joe Manchin, whenever you're ready, you come and tell me and I will go find it for you. And all you have to do is give me a little tip.
Oh, well, that's the role of the Senate Majority Leader, I guess, these days.
Here is Representative Cori Bush and Representative Jamal Bowman. Bush, of course, from St. Louis, and Bowman from New York, on CNN's New Day with John Berman.
The expectation is we will give you crumbs and expect you to be happy. What we're saying is I didn't come to Congress to continue to give crumbs to my community. St. Louis continues to get crumbs and we keep being number one for homicide, number one or number two for homicides, number one for police murder, number one for the murder of children. We keep having those issues. We keep having issues with 10 black children being 10 times as likely to go to the hospital, to an emergency room for asthma than white children. How do we fix those things? You have to put the money there. And so I didn't come to Congress to sit back and accept those crumbs. Give my folks the meal. And that is why we're here, to push that.
No, don't ask us why aren't we willing to compromise. Ask Joe Manchin, yes. Is he okay with violence in our communities continuing, public housing falling apart, black and brown people disproportionately dying from COVID, the climate crisis? Ask him to go bigger instead of asking us to go smaller.
To be clear, we're asking every member, you know, where they're going to go and where the possible agreements can be reached. Paul Begala was on earlier today and talked about progress versus perfection.
We're talking about a package that is not even perfection.
$3.5 trillion was the compromise.
Right, that was the compromise. This is not
President
perfection.
Biden came in at $6 trillion.
Again, yes. And I'm making the argument that Joe Manchin is making here, because he's not sitting here, but he would say $1.5 trillion. Isn't crumbs.
Tell Joe Manchin to come to my district.
That's right.
Tell him to come to my district. Tell him to meet with me, and I'll take him to see what happens when you give a little of something and you expect people to live off of that. Because what'll happen is that $1.5 trillion or whatever it turns out to be that he wants, it'll be, oh, we did something for you.
Mm-hmm. We spend $7.6 trillion on the military alone every 10 years.
Yes.
And it's okay for us to spend that money. No one bats an eye, but we're looking to spend 3.5 over 10 years that most of it is paid for on a bottom-up economy to target those most vulnerable, and we have a problem with that. Black and brown people, black and brown women, indigenous people, poor people, we always have to wait. You always ask, not you, the government, always ask us to kick the can down the road for the most vulnerable. And people, to me, that's unacceptable.
The Bowman brings up the real point there. Yeah. I mean, if you're saying $1.5 trillion is not crumbs, my response is $7.5 trillion in military spending. And let's be clear, I don't know that we've had a year, at least in the past 3 or 4 or 5 years, where that number hasn't gone up.
Yeah.
They keep getting a bump. I mean, this year, Congress gave the Pentagon more than they asked for.
Yeah, they do that every year. Oh, here's a little sweetener, a little cherry on top while we got to cut. For
this year, it's going to be $760, $770 billion dollars. Next year, it's probably going to be closer to $800 billion. By the time you get 10 years out, you could be talking about another $100 billion, functionally $1 trillion over the course of 10 years.
Which is half of what we would be spending on that year with this current proposal for Build Back Better, $190 billion. That's how you reframe it. Like Bowman exactly. made the key point there, but Corey punches back. Together, they're just, you know, a great tandem. And you saw how Berman was just holding up the last.
It's not me.
I'm just playing the role of Joe Manchin. It's definitely not my position. And they also never ever substantively talk about what is in that top right. line number and what is getting cut. 1.9 trillion sounds big, right? Okay, that satiates the audience. What are the parts that are getting done away with? Are we going to talk about what those cuts mean, or are we just going to be like, big number, smaller number, compromise? That's not politics. We're talking about policies that affect people's lives. I don't care about the number if it's just garbage in it, which is pretty much what the bipartisan infrastructure package contains. So let's talk about the policies within these structures and not just, you know, the surface level figure.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be speaking to Carl Linskoog, assistant professor of history at Raritan Valley Community College, author of Detain and Punish, Haitian Refugees in the World's Largest Immigration Detention System. Folks, today's program sponsored by one of our favorite sponsors. I want to bring these guys down to Boston, actually. It's a little bit of a hike from Burlington, but it's not too much. Mm. Of course, I'm speaking of Sunset Lake, Sebede.com. Yes, Sunset Lake, Sebede.com. They've got an amazing array of smokables, Keith's, Smalls, pre-rolls. They've got fudge, coffee, gummies. They've got salves with arnica. They've got lotion, like, what do you call it? Skin lotion with sebede.
That is good skin lotion.
Tincture. All of their products are tested by third parties. They practice regenerative farming, integrated pest management, 100% organic fertilizer. They also have great business practices, $15 minimum wage, but they're mostly an employee-owned company. I can't say enough about both their business practices, their being a movement partner, very supportive of, we've talked about this, of the money that we raise for Afghan refugees and for the nurses in Worcester and programs in and around Burlington. Just all around great folks up there. But the bottom line is people love their product. We get emails on a regular basis thanking us. I will admit, and Matt was too, skeptics. In the past, I had tried Sebede and not been terribly impressed. But now it is extremely helpful in terms of sleeping for me. It's also, I use it a little recreationally at times. And frankly, there are days when the kids, the kids are a little bit difficult. So I will, you know, have a little tincture maybe during the day, or a little fudge. Yeah. And they're giving you 20% off with their coupon code LEFTISBEST. I know Matt uses this keef and mixes it with some other stuff and whatever.
Good keef, got an ounce of it.
SunsetLakeSebede.com. 20% off. Use the code LEFTISBEST, all one word. You will not regret it, folks. I promise you. So much of their business is return customers, and it makes total sense. All right. Now, speaking of Boston, we made the announcement yesterday, right? Was it yesterday?
Yes.
We are going to be doing a live show in Boston, Massachusetts on January, January 16th at 3 p.m. Eastern time. So the people who are traveling in can make it there and back and this and that. We're going to be live in Boston. The whole crew is going to be there. We're going to have some guests. I haven't quite decided on whom yet. And tickets are on sale now at the famed Wilbur Theater. When I've told my buddies from Boston, we're going to be at the Wilbur. They're like, what?
Mm.
They're like, what? You going to the Wilbur? Seriously? Holy shit. Dude, are you serious? Yeah, I'm serious.
It is sort of adequately grandiose for the show, I think.
Super grandiose. Are you kidding me? Who do you think you are? Like that guy who plays like Itzhak Perlman? Here is the presale code. If you are a member of this program, you will hear the presale code when I say it. If you have signed up for the AM Quickie newsletter, which you go to majority.fm, go all the way down to the bottom, put your email in, you will get it tomorrow morning. Here it is. The code is...
complicated.
The code is...
people were wondering if this was a cue drop the other day.
Oh, is that right? And now, if you're not a member, you won't have heard that because Matt will take it out.
Special post. Technology.
Oh, wow.
Or he'll put some type of thing there. So become a member. Otherwise, wait till Friday and, you know, look.
Maybe it'll be sold out.
Chances are it's not going to be sold out by Friday.
That's a great way to drive membership.
Well, I'm not going to lie. Okay. I mean, the Wilbur is a big theater. But I think it's, I'm not sure if the seating is specific seating. But also, do you really want to risk it?
How big is it?
It's pretty big. Dude, this is like where you go if you're...
Google image it.
Yeah, if you're a... I mean, it's the Wilbur Theater.
Oh, no.
Are you kidding? It's a huge deal. That place is fancy.
I'm worried.
Yeah, you should be. all right. But so check that out, folks. And we will put the link in the description.
It is really big.
And if you are a member, you can find the code in the member post from today. All right. I want to welcome to the program Carl Linskoog, assistant professor of history at Raritan Valley Community College, author of Detain and Punish, Haitian Refugees in the World's Largest Immigration Detention System. Carl, thanks for joining us. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Thank you for having me.
Obviously, very much in the news right now in terms of Haitian immigration in particular. I mean, of course, this was also an issue during the Trump years. I mean, and frankly, it's been a big issue in this country for decades now. And our, you know, we have talked at some length on this program about America's relationship with Haiti for multiple centuries now. But your book makes the case that in many ways, our current immigration system is a function of the way that we view specifically Haitian immigrants, that it was built up around a response to Haitian immigration. And then, of course, it gets applied to immigrants, or not all immigrants, but some immigrants or a lot of immigrants sort of writ large. When does that story begin?
Well, as you say, it's a function and it's an outgrowth of a much longer history between the United States and Haiti, and it stems from the Haitian Revolution. But more recently, it really begins in the 1970s when the first so-called Haitian boat people, Haitian asylum seekers coming by boat to the United States, start arriving on American shores and asking for security and asylum. It's that point when the U.S. government implements a policy to try to deter them from coming and to keep them out of American communities. It starts putting them in jails and prisons. and applying a blanket denial of asylum to them so that it can expel and deport them quickly and keep them from American communities. So to the extent that our whole immigration system in the 1980s and 1990s becomes much more punitive and applies the illegal status to all kinds of foreign-born people, it's really doing that in many ways, especially when it comes to detention to Haitians first, and then it expands to many other groups.
And I want to circle back to the idea that we called Haitian immigrants boat people, but a lot of immigrants come to this country by boat, they're just immigrants, or they're just people. Well, let's just go back though, and just give us a little bit of a history of, you know, where we were in the 50s in terms of immigration. In many respects, our immigration system starts about 30 years before that or so, when we're looking to exclude people. Specifically at that time, it was more the Chinese. But let's take it from the 50s and work our way up, because something turns in the 70s with Haitian immigrants.
Yes, that's right. So in the 1950s, can you hear me? It looks like
I'm having some
connectivity issues, but okay, great, thank you. In the 1950s, we're about two or more decades into a period of immigration restriction. There was an Immigration Restriction Act in 1924 that severely limits immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe, that bans all Asian immigrants, and that sort of curates the population, the immigrant population, according to the standards of preference for Northern and Western, European immigrants. But in 1954, maybe as a function of that, they suspend the policy of immigration detention, which had been in effect for a number of years previously, really since the first immigration stations on Ellis Island and Angel Island were established. And they say, you know, we don't need to lock up immigrants anymore. We can release them and process them and allow them to come back if they need to for their court hearings and their immigration dates. So immigration detention, although it continues in some respects, isn't formally a part of American policy from 1954 onward, when the Haitian asylum seekers started coming in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. We refer to that as parole. Right. I mean, just so that we know where we are in terms of terms. That's the way we refer to it as parole. Like, that's become a period of time. And it just came up recently with Afghan immigrants, too. That's the period of time where we allow immigrants to be in the country where their status has yet to be determined. But we're not trying to round them up. INS or Customs and Border is not trying to go after them.
That's right. And it's based on the idea that, you know, most immigrants are not a threat to public health and safety, and that they should be allowed to live their lives, you know, in freedom and dignity until we can figure out what their status is going to be in this country. And so you're right that was that policy for at least many immigrants in the middle decades of the 20th century. That starts to shift when Haitian asylum seekers start to come. It's part of a larger racist reaction to what's happening in immigration, because in 1965, they changed the immigration laws to do away with the racist national origins quotas. But also it allows many more immigrants from Latin America and Asia to start coming in. And also in reaction to some of the civil rights and liberation struggles of the 1960s and 70s, there's this racist backlash. And that's part of what's responding to the arrival of Haitian asylum seekers. And so it's in Florida, and then increasingly nationally, there's this desire to keep out what people viewed as poor Black foreign-born people from Haiti. And they start to use that tool of detention and imprisoning immigrants to try to enforce a more restrictive idea of immigration restriction.
Okay, and so we're in the 70s. There's this issue of boat people. I mean, Cuban immigrants come by boat. Why is it that only Haitian immigrants are boat people?
Cuban immigrants had received preferential treatment for some time, as at least since the Cuban Revolution of 1959, and that then produces a number of anti-communist exiles to the United States. It's during the Cold War, and so the United States is wanting to welcome asylum seekers and refugees that are fleeing communist nations, because to the United States government, it demonstrates that they're facing persecution. Haiti, unfortunately for Haitian asylum seekers, is being ruled by the Duvalier dictatorship, which was anti-communist and a convenient ally of the United States in the Caribbean. And so in addition to racist, xenophobic reaction to Haitians, there's a geopolitical interest there in maintaining a relationship with an anti-communist ally in the Caribbean, despite the fact that Haitians and Cubans have a very similar profile.
I mean, it's fascinating to me. Like, you could say they're escaping a brutal dictator, or that they're, you know, you could say refugees, but boat people, I don't know that. I mean, I remember that as a kid, frankly. So talk about what we have after. I mean, this is Jimmy Carter's administration. What is Carter's, I mean, where, what is behind this detention? Is it simply that they want to maintain the U.S. wants to maintain relationships with Duvalier, or is it there is some other impetus here, or is it just simply a question of racism?
I think it is in part geostrategic, and it's about the Cold War. But I also think that if you look at what happened sort of on the ground in Florida in the 1970s, there's a push by local officials toward Washington and the State Department to restrict Haitians, because it was seen that they were going to be a disruptive force and their local constituents didn't like that. But really a major shift continues and really propels it much further forward in the 1980s, when in the summer of 1980, more than 100,000 Cubans and roughly 15,000 Haitians all arrived in the summer on American shores. And that was really the first time that the United States was in this position of just receiving huge numbers of asylum seekers showing up and asking for asylum. Our immigration law wasn't very well suited to handle that. And I think that really planted a fear in many American officials' minds that, you know, unless we do something to stop this, we may be, you know, continuing to receive huge numbers of asylum seekers from throughout Latin America. And part of their response to try to deter Haitian asylum seekers was also, we want to make sure, you know, it's not the Central American asylum seekers that are fleeing U.S.-backed wars in places like El Salvador and Guatemala. We could be any number of countries in the future. What we do here, they reasoned, is could be a precedent and something we can apply to many other groups. And it turns out they did, to try to keep asylum seekers from the United States.
I mean, this is the dynamic where the Haitian immigrant becomes sort of the canary in the coal mine is not necessarily the right analogy, but essentially this is our test case. You're our pilot program. And if it works with you, we'll apply it to others. Mm-hmm. What also I did not realize was, I mean, I remember 10 years ago reading shareholder reports in the private prison industry, where they were pivoting from, like, we are afraid we're going to see some type of criminal justice reform. So, we're going to have a supply problem, or at least I guess a demand problem in that respect. But we see big potential in the immigrant detention space. But that is actually not a new phenomenon. That's actually what kicked off that industry, was immigrant detention. Mm-hmm. Yeah, tell us about that.
Yes. So the very first private prisons in this country were immigration detention facilities. Some of these big names, like Corrections Corporations of America, which becomes CoreCivic, started out in immigration detention. And for a while, they're making huge profits detaining both native and foreign-born people, because this is in the 1990s, where you sort of have this increasing criminalization of immigration and also the war on drugs and mass racialized mass incarceration. But more recently, as you say, where you have a massive social movement to try to move towards decriminalization and move against mass incarceration, there's still, for many people, the idea that you need to imprison illegal immigrants. And so that's still a very profitable thing, especially when there's a mandate for a certain number of a quota that needs to be filled, so that you arresting and imprisoning so many immigrants per year. And that's definitely continues to add to the profits. And also, I should just say that, you know, immigrants are the most profitable people to imprison, because mostly they're not criminals. They don't cost a lot of money to, you know, incarcerate. And you get huge amounts of money from the federal and different kinds of governments to do this. Our local and county jails are imprisoning immigrants and making a lot of money where they're sometimes not receiving a lot of other revenue. So it is a big part of the prison industrial complex. And it has been since the 1980s when it all really got started.
Also, we should say that it's not just the private prison industry, which basically launched off of Haitian immigrants. To what extent was Guantanamo a detention center before it was used for Haitian immigrants?
Well, yeah, I mean, the United States obtains the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay as a result of the Spanish-American War. And it's used in various purposes, but it's really in the early 1990s, when Haiti's going through a military coup, that the presidency of George H.W. Bush starts using Guantanamo as an offshore detention facility for Haitian asylum seekers. And, you know, Haitians are the original Guantanamo detainees. Many Americans learn about Guantanamo, you know, learned about it as after 9/11 and as a black site where people were tortured. But, you know, Haitians endured torture and violence and great hardship at Guantanamo before it became a tragic site in the war on terror.
And then what was the Clinton administration's role in continuing these detentions at Gitmo?
Mm-hmm. Clinton, when he's running for president, pledges to reverse the most cruel elements of the George H.W. Bush policy in regards to Haitians, and says we won't keep returning them directly to Haiti, we won't imprison them. But after he's elected, he does an about face, and he continues to return people to Haiti, and he also continues to use Guantanamo as a detention facility. In fact, it's under the Clinton years rather than the Bush years that some of the most intense confrontations between Haitian prisoners there and the guards really happen, especially in a camp that was devoted to the detention of HIV-positive patients who weren't allowed to enter because of their health status. They have a lot of resistance, and it's brutally suppressed, and that's one of the legacies of Clinton's immigration policy in the Clinton years.
I want to go back to the Reagan years, too, because we sort of skipped over that, but since we're here, that dynamic with in terms of AIDS and in terms of Haitian immigrants being denied, and people should be clear here, right? Like, all of this concept of asylum seekers and refugees is a function of international law that is developed in the wake largely of World War II. I mean, so this is a situation where the United States is trying to figure out, how do we appear to be upholding international law in this regard, but how do we really undercut the implications of that law by hook or crook? And so when we are detaining and essentially, you know, we're trying to squeeze into some daylight between, you know, where the international law is and, frankly, also our own statutes in regarding asylum seekers. The preventing of even the processing of Haitian immigrants when they're at Guantanamo because they may or may not have AIDS, How much of that is a model for what we see today with Title 42?
I think it's a very important precursor to what the Trump and now the Biden administration is doing, using public health as a pretext to block and then expel Haitians and other people from being, you know, legally, as you mentioned, admitted to this land and allow them to file their asylum claims, which, as you said, they have the internationally recognized and according to our federal law, right to do. You know, first, actually, before it was even AIDS for Haitians, it was association with tuberculosis in the 1970s. Tuberculosis was supposed to be the reason to keep Haitians out. Then in the 1980s and 1990s, it was AIDS. There was a special, as we mentioned, prison camp in Guantanamo just quarantining Haitians who had were HIV positive from coming here. And, you know, this is a history that extends before and up to today regarding Title 42 in the, our current pandemic and really, I would say, illegitimate use of a public health law to in the immigration context.
All right, let's go back to the '80s and during the Reagan administration, and we should say that by was it 85, 86, there was a sort of a an immigration bill that provided, you know, what the right would call amnesty, many would just simply call like an ability to become citizens for immigrants. But how much of what Reagan was, how sensitive was the Reagan administration to the idea of this many black immigrants coming in? I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan, I don't even think Ronald Reagan would take offense to me characterizing it that way, frankly.
So, you're right that there was immigration reform in 1986 that had the both the carrot and the stick of, you know, offering a path to legalizing one's status. But there were also new punishments for employers and people working illegally. So there were the two sides of that. But I would definitely say that the Reagan administration, while in the papers and things that I examined, is not often explicitly saying we want to keep black, you know, migrants or asylum seekers out. We don't want Haitians because they're black. It seems quite clear. And the advocates and activists also saw this on the ground as they were struggling around these issues, that there was a racist motive for this, just as there is a racial and racist element to our immigration enforcement today. I think it's also especially clear when you look at what the Reagan administration was doing in other, maybe non-immigration contexts. The war on drugs, the building of the prison system, even the way that Reagan launched his campaign for presidency in Mississippi, talking about, you know, we're going to return this to a states' rights kinds of things. Well, when you say that kind of thing in Mississippi, people know what that means. It's a pushback against civil rights. And I think if you examine the Reagan record more broadly, the anti-Haitian program is very consistent with a larger effort to advance or resuscitate white supremacy that I think is clearly going on in the Reagan years.
We should say, just as a reminder to people, Reagan, after winning the nomination in 1980 for the Republican Party, traveled to Philadelphia, Mississippi. He actually went to, the Neshoba County Fair, 2 or 3 miles from where those civil rights workers, if you've ever seen the movie Mississippi Burning, were killed. And the cry of those people and the people who are supportive of the people who killed those civil rights workers were like, you know, you federal government can't tell us what to do in our state. And so to go there and to proclaim that his campaign is about states' rights sends a very not so subtle message. We should also say, just as long as we're doing context, he had a lawyer in his Justice Department in the Office of Legal Counsel, I think it was, or maybe it was the Civil Rights Division, who was insistent that Reagan not sign the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act. And that, young baby-faced lawyer grew up to be the Supreme Court, the Chief Supreme Court Justice, John Roberts. Just to give you a sense, yes, it's wonderful how they all move forward. But I want to talk a little bit, and then you know we can go back up, through the years up into the Clinton years, because we have some real questions about the Clintons. But we start to see some pushback, both from the Haitian immigrant community, but also legal challenges. Talk about the hunger strike that was ongoing in Alderson, West Virginia, at that time.
Yeah, and that's just one example of a lot of direct action within jails and detention facilities, really from the very moment that Haitian refugees and asylum seekers are being incarcerated. They had a very powerful way of utilizing direct action and then tying their action to what allies and advocates were doing on the outside to sort of amplify the call for freedom and just treatment. They partnered with Black American organizations, churches, labor organizations, civil rights coalitions to really sort of center the injustice and unjust treatment of Haitians to a broader set of issues. And very often it was galvanized by the hunger strikes and the direct actions that were happening in West Virginia, in the Chrome Avenue Detention Center in Miami, and really everywhere where Haitians were detained.
I know you had a question about the Clintons, because as we get into through the Herbert Walker Bush regime, then we're into the Clinton years. I mean, the Clintons had
bizarre relationship with Haiti, right? Well, I don't need to cut you off, I'm wondering if you could expand on how this time period cemented the Clintons' relationship with Haiti and, I would say, weird white savior fixation, but also a way to expand their own capitalist interests there through their foundation and a variety of other mechanisms. This is still ongoing, their involvement in the country. Can you, I guess, expand on that relationship and what that meant from the presidency to the present day?
Yes. So it was during the Clinton years that the Aristide presidency was restored in Haiti. And, you know, it took a U.S. Military invasion of the country to do that, to restore the democratically elected presidency of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. That was seen as a victory for democratic institutions and to a degree, supporting the popular movement and popular institutions that had brought Aristide to power. But there were many people who said, but we don't really want it to happen at the hands of a U.S. military occupation. We've been here before. And the other thing that happens with Clinton that I think sort of sets the stage for some of what comes later is that Aristide was required to agree to a whole set of neoliberal policies that he would adopt in Haiti that were very sort of antithetical to the kinds of things the grassroots movement wanted and that he was standing for before he was ousted by a military coup. So that's another important turning point. Clinton and the Clinton administration required that adoption of neoliberalism as a condition of returning to power. And I would say that neoliberalism has done a lot of continuing damage to Haiti. And I think, you know, a lot of Haitians recognize that and they feel quite ambivalent, you might say, towards Clinton, despite the fact that, you know, after the earthquake in 2010, he sort of set up as the ambassador to Haiti who's going to help oversee the reconstruction, which doesn't happen very effectively even after more than a decade. I think there's even before the coup and the restoration of the Aristide government, the Clinton administration has a troubled relationship with Haiti, as evidenced by his treatment of Haitian asylum seekers. But I think especially the U.S. invasion, occupation, and imposition of neoliberalism is an important continuing souring of that relationship.
What happens on the immigration front from the, and we just had, the numbers seem to be all over the place in terms of the way that it's reporting. I've seen anywhere from 8,000 to 16,000 Haitian immigrants cross the border over the past, I guess a couple of months, and people, you know, they were living largely under a bridge in Texas. It is still unclear to me, many sort of conflicting reports, how many were allowed to stay in this country, how many were sort of summarily, I don't even want to use the word deported because they weren't processed in any way, they were expelled. I've seen reporting that suggests these immigrants were actually largely immigrants, really refugees from that 2010 earthquake, that they had been living in South and Central America, and over the years things had become difficult, and they had sort of migrated up and were looking for some form, I guess, of temporary protected status in this country. Do you have any sense of that? And then also, what happens in the interim between the Clinton administration's in ending in 2000 and really over the course of the past 15, 20 years in regard to Haitian immigration? Mm-hmm.
Yes. So you're right that, over the last few years, it's not just a recent thing, but Haitian asylum seekers have been making their way to the U.S.-Mexico border and trying to seek safety and security here. Many of them were displaced by the 2010 earthquake, and as you say, did find employment and a home for a period in places like Brazil and Chile. But when some of those situations became unsustainable, they continued to move, as people do, and made their way to the U.S.-Mexico border. And it wasn't even just something in the last few months. This has been happening for years. In the years since Clinton, under George W. Bush, and then Barack Obama, the policy towards Haiti and Haitian refugees has remained largely the same. There are a couple high-profile moments where it's actually very parallel in terms of what's happening from the 1970s and 80s. But I would say that the policy towards Haitian asylum seekers is very similar. There's a temporary suspension for about 6 years, I believe, after the 2010 earthquake, where there's not a lot of, where there's temporary protected status extended to Haitians, and Haitian deportations to Haiti are not being pursued aggressively. But I believe it was in 2016 under Obama, 2014, I have to check my years there. But I believe Obama was the one that resumed deportations to Haiti and sort of said that that period after the earthquake is ending, and we're going to resume what has historically been our approach towards Haitian asylum seekers and refugees.
And then during the Trump years, we see an assault on the concept of the temporary protected status. I mean, we had Haitians living in this country for 5, 6, you know, as time went on, 7, 8 years, 9 years, who had come because the rebuilding efforts, like you said, after the 2010 earthquake have been, you know, mediocre at best, I guess you could characterize it. And so there just wasn't the opportunity for people to go back and resume their lives, find their homes, find jobs, et cetera, et cetera. Trump was really looking to deport these people as well. Where does this go from here? I mean, I just saw a report today, I think, that the Custom and Border Patrol has arrested more people in this 10-month period by a factor of what, I don't know, than, you know, in anywhere in recent memory. it does not feel like Joe Biden is going to expend any capital, although at this point, although who knows later, on helping the Haitian people who have just gone through multiple, you know, disasters, including a massive earthquake, a hurricane, and an assassination of the presidency. Where does this trajectory go forward from here?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it seems so far, you're right, that the Biden administration is not only mostly continuing the Trump administration's practice of blocking and expelling Haitian asylum seekers, but, you know, intensifying it. Many more Haitians were expelled under the Title 42 provisions than in the last years of the Trump administration. I think the Biden administration officials might feel vulnerable to this claim that, you know, by sort of dropping some of the most cruel aspects of the Trump administration's policy, it's inviting asylum seekers en masse to come to the border. And so therefore it might be trying to, you know, be a little harsh, more harsh, in order to politically sort of defend against those claims. But I want to add that just as in the 70s, 80s, 90s, early 2000s, there's a pretty active grassroots movement that is calling on the Biden administration to actually match its practice with its rhetoric, because it, you know, when Trump made his racist derogatory claims about Haitian and African migrants, the Biden administration condemned it. And it said, you know, we're going to have a more humane policy towards foreign-born people, immigrants, refugees. And so now groups like UndocuBlack and the Haitian Bridge Alliance are saying, you know, let's actually get rid of racism in our immigration policy and start treating Haitians and other Black migrants and all other people humanely, like you said you were going to, and stop doing what the Trump administration is doing. And we'll see how much power they can mobilize and pressure they can mobilize on the Biden administration. We'll see if President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris choose to be responsive to that movement.
Yeah. I guess we will. So far, I got to say, it sort of feels like there's not a lot of, I mean, I don't know how much boldness you need to treat people with humanity, but to the extent that you do, they're not exhibiting a ton of it at this point.
I mean, it's even worse than I thought it would be, honestly, with them.
Yeah, it's rough. Well, Carl Linskog, the book is Detain and Punish: Haitian Refugees and the World's Largest Immigration Detention System. We will put a link to that book at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back to wrap things up for our Peacock viewers and head into the second half of this program, as we do every day. Be right back. We were just saying at the break that it is if you look at, there is a parallel universe where our immigration system is built upon the idea of this country has largely been, built upon the ideas and the durability that comes from having different populations in our country, and that we have the resources and we have the ability to welcome people into this country. Our immigration system has not been built that way. It has been built upon how do we prevent Chinese people from coming in? Or then it develops to like, how do we prevent, Italians from coming in? And then how do we prevent Haitians from coming in?
And when they do come in, how do we criminalize them through the war on drugs?
And make sure that they serve capitalists, only let in just enough to serve whatever sort of industries we need their labor for.
Right. On one hand, I have I'm going with my kid to Ellis Island and it's really cute. And then the other hand, it's like, oh, wait a second. This is really, no, it's not really about that. And, Haitian immigrants became sort of like it was our racism that became the sort of disruptive innovation on how we can, different ways we could detain these people. And of course, build the private prison industry. So there you have it.
Have a lovely day with that thought in your mind.
And if you're watching this on Peacock, we will see you tomorrow.
Everything you know about America is a lie. See you later.
We will see you then. And if you're still with us, but now we get to the fun part. Mm. In fact, it's so fun. We call it the fun half. It's not actually the halfway mark. It's less than halfway mark. And it's not always fun, but that doesn't mean that we can't brand it that way.
Right.
And we do. Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. If you want this program to survive and thrive, become a member. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show. And then you get extra content every day. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget the AM Quickie. Got a special, what do they call it? Chestnut? What do you call it? Easter egg. There's an Easter egg in it.
That's how I know. One of the many reasons I know you hate Marvel.
I hate Marvel.
Right? There's always Easter eggs in the credits, so like Marvel movies.
I also don't celebrate Easter, so there's that. Mm. But nevertheless, if you sign up for the AM Quickie, tomorrow you will get it in your email inbox, and it will have the special pre-sale code for the live show. Check it out. Go to majority.fm, scroll down, put in your email address. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. It's a fair trade company. One of our movement sponsors, I call them. Somebody told me that once, during the Cernovich thing. I was like, yeah, no, it was Just Coffee. They tipped me off to what Cernovich was doing. Go, oh, yeah, because they're like a movement sponsor. And I'm like, yes.
Perfect way to...
Yes, that's absolutely right. They are. That's exactly right. So check it out. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate, 10% off. Coupon code MAJORITY. And join our Discord. MajorityDiscord.com. Hang out there. Check out Nomi Show, YouTube.com/TheNomiKeyShow. And Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian? That's not the MCU.
MLU. Yeah, something like that. Branko Marchetich of Jacobin. He was the author of Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. We're going to be talking to him about why it still feels a lot like yesterday with Joe Biden and his failure to get his agenda through. So that's tonight, 8 Eastern, 7 Central, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get our postgame. Mm.
What about Pacific?
I think that would be a five.
Yeah, I'm just curious. You say five. Eight Eastern, seven Central, but you don't want.
And David negotiated for Central Time to be the official time zone of Left Reckoning.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So I do say 7 Central.
So what would you say? Like 75% of your guests are not there on time?
Yeah, exactly. It's causing some issues.
Folks, 646-257-3920 is the number. We will, in fact, be taking your phone calls today. So if you're one of those people who've been trying to get through, we're not going to take all of your calls. We can't. We get 25 calls stacked up at a time, but we'll take some. See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're not paying.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
Do.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.